This is Speaking of Purpose, where we talk to real people making real change. I'm your host, Sona Khosla, Chief Impact Officer at Benevity. This show is brought to you by Benevity, the world's leading enterprise impact platform, helping companies deliver purpose at work. Today, we're recording a very special episode focused on Minneapolis. 2026 has been a significant and difficult year for the residents of the city and the state.
This wasn't abstract. It was really deeply personal, both for me, for my friends and community and family members.
Early this year, a series of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, operations in the city drew widespread attention and sparked significant community response. The operations resulted in multiple detentions, and in two separate incidents, Renee Good and Alex Preddy were fatally shot by ICE officers.
Everybody was afraid. The fear was just potent. You'd walk out into the streets, get into your car, and even if you personally were not potentially in danger, there was a fear that permeated the city.
We're going to talk about how these events were and continue to be felt in the city. We will discuss the varied response and in some cases, absence of response from companies that make their home in the state.
Don't just say something and then not do anything about it. The line between the community issue and the business issue really disappeared.
We're also going to talk about the good. Our guest today is Andrea Wood, President and CEO of the Association of Corporate Citizenship Professionals. Andrea has been a corporate purpose professional for over three decades and has helped companies navigate tumultuous times, many times before. Her perspective on Minneapolis is especially poignant because she lives there.
And again, this wasn't political. This was really about people seeing their neighbors in need, seeing their communities in need, and saying, okay, it's time to help.
Andrea, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So great to have you here. I was thinking we could start with you sharing what it's been like in Minneapolis over the past several months and what you've witnessed in your own community.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was a rough winter for everyone who was here. And, you know, in watching the news coverage of Minneapolis and what was happening, you know, it felt surreal because we were in the middle of it. This wasn't abstract. It was really deeply personal. Both for me, for my, you know, friends and community and family members, but also for the businesses and the employees who are based here. Everybody was afraid. The fear was just potent. You'd walk out into the streets, you'd get into your car. And even if you personally were not potentially in danger, there was a fear that permeated the city. And I think that takes a real toll on individuals, but also, you know, companies, employees, you know, companies felt a lot of impact from this. Some attendance dropped, you know, people were afraid to come to work. Morale declined. People just felt unsafe and uneasy. And I think, you know, when it comes to businesses and corporate leaders, they really had to, I think, internalize and understand that this was not external to them. People stopped going out. They stopped shopping. They stopped going to restaurants. They stopped going to theater because of what's happening across the community. That creates issues for corporate headquarters communities as well.
Yeah, it's a really interesting insight, that blurring of the, you know, the human line and the business line and how, you know, the two play in this dynamic, because in this world now, we don't separate those things.
Exactly. Right.
And nor should we, nor can we. And with something that that intense happening, affecting the city on every angle at every level, and it sounds like everyone was affected. Even if you're not affected, you are a part of that system, feeling that heaviness in the air. So thank you, Andrea, for sharing that. It's feel like I got a good sense of what it might feel like. I mean, for us who are watching on the outside, empathizing, wondering, you know, what we can do. It's really helpful to hear your voice from the ground. And while, you know, there was all that heaviness, we also saw people really showing up for each other. On the Benevity platform alone, we saw more than 200% year-over-year growth in donation volume to organizations based in Minnesota, and organizations of all kinds, right? Money being directed to organizations that provide resources to immigrants, to legal support, food and housing, and many other mutual aid type organizations. So I'm curious, Andrea, what you saw being on the ground in terms of what kind of help was proliferating.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, it made me so proud to be a resident here and to be part of this community, to see how everybody stepped up and came together. And again, this wasn't political. This was really about people understanding, seeing their neighbors in need, seeing their communities in need, and saying, okay, it's time to help, right? I can't just stand by and not, and watch my neighbors suffer as they don't have access to food, or they're afraid, you know, to take their kids to school, but their kids really don't need to go to school. I mean, there's so much community support. And so I felt really proud of that. And it's actually still happening. You know, the news media sort of has walked away, has lost interest, but the need is still there. The economic impact to this community is going to be long and hard. You know, there are businesses that really struggled during this time and are barely making it right now, trying to stay afloat. In fact, one of the things that I love, the Minneapolis Foundation started a fund for restaurants, because restaurants, you know, obviously took a big hit as people were not going out at all. And winter is hard in Minnesota anyway, because people, it's too cold, people don't want to go out, right? But then you know, you top that with the fear of going out in the community. And so businesses had shut their doors for a long time, you know, just closed up, or, you know, they were limiting the number of people who could come in, or they couldn't get their workers to come in. And so they couldn't actually service people. So, you know, as an example, the Minneapolis Foundation saw that need and started a fund that companies and individuals could donate to, just to support the restaurant community, to, you know, to try to make sure that they could make it through this very difficult time. But, you know, I was part of a group that was delivering food to families who couldn't get out. You know, there was lots of funds that were being set up for rental assistance for families who were struggling with rent. And that's, again, that's still happening. You know, people are still supporting and should be supporting that, because it's still a big need. So the recovery process is going to be long, but I did feel really proud of, you know, again, regardless of your political opinions or affiliations, people saw the need. They saw that families were suffering. They saw that you know, kids weren't getting food, or kids weren't getting to school, or, you know, families weren't able to pay their rent, all of those basic needs things. And they stepped up, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's not an abstract idea happening out there. It's happening to your friends, your children's friends, your coworkers, right? There's nothing more immediate than
exactly.
That. And in a way, it kind of disarms the political debate as well, because it's just, it's, to your point, it's personal, not political at that point, because it's people you've known and have relationships with who live in your community. It's really, really powerful, Andrea. And I think you're kind of touching on one of the themes that we really saw, which was this concept of, you know, peer-to-peer support and mutual aid. What was really interesting is, you know, there was definitely money going to Minnesota-based organizations, nonprofits, like you described, but there was also a massive amount of fundraising on platforms like GoFundMe, you know, for the families of people who were affected, like Renee Good and Alex Preddy, that raised over $3 million. And so I'm really curious about your perspective about how these two things kind of played side by side. Like, how did the nonprofit community really show up? And then how did that kind of more one-to-one support show up?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer is that we needed both, right? Because it was such a crisis and there was such an immediate need that, Feeding America, which is the Second Harvest Heartland, which is the Feeding America affiliate here, was doing everything it could to meet the incredible demand for food support. But they could not, as a one organization, fulfill the needs, particularly as it relates to families not being willing to go and pick up food on their own. And so, you know, you had to rely on these, you know, smaller networks of communities, neighborhoods, churches, who would take families in and say, okay, you know, we're going to shop for you. We're going to deliver food to you for the foreseeable future, and we're going to, you know, take care of your families. And so it really needed to be both. The same with rental assistance. You know, there are lots of formal rental assistance programs you have to apply for. And, you know, I think those organizations that were managing those were trying to move as quickly as possible. But in some cases, there was not enough time for families to get the support that they needed in order to not be evicted, right? And so those, you know, the grassroots, the GoFundMes, the Venmos, you know, I was just, me personally, I had a friend who was managing food for families, and I was just Venmoing her my money, right? You know, so I mean, because you just, it had to be quick, right? Like, she needed the money now, the family needed the groceries now, right? Like, you couldn't go through a whole process with them, right? And so that, again, really amazing. And it speaks to, you know, people are generous of heart. People want to help each other. They want to support their neighbors. And that suffering, the suffering of their neighbors, was very real to them. It was really hard to escape. I was just reading a story recently in the Star Tribune, because even in the suburbs, you would think the suburbs would be a little more protected from what was happening. But there was a restaurant and a strip mall in a suburban area, you know, pretty quiet suburban area, where the owner was arrested in the parking lot here legally, you know. So there was, you know, a lot of, you know, and then within an hour, he was on a plane to Texas. And so the disruption of local businesses, and then it becomes personal, because then, you know, that's your neighbor, that's the restaurant owner you go and get your takeout, you know, and so you have a relationship, it becomes very personal. And so that was, again, I think, again, I'm really proud, but we needed, you know, both the formal support, we needed the structured funds, because they can do more, and they can take larger donations, but we also needed the quick and rapid response that happened through Venmo and GoFundMe and other venues.
Yeah, and Andre, I'm wondering if you've got some advice or some insights that you would want to share with corporate impact leaders who, you know, in these moments are trying to mobilize support as quickly as possible, enable their employees to get involved, you know, working with grantees and partners on the ground. They're trying to move as fast as possible as well. Is there something here for corporate impact leaders to learn about what unfolded in Minnesota in terms of the forms of support? Like, would you say there's some ideas here around how corporate impact leaders could mobilize support more effectively in these moments? Or do you feel like everyone really played their role appropriately? And, you know, did that ecosystem work from a corporate perspective? What could they take away?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting because there are a lot of analogies to how corporations are responding here to how they respond to disasters, right? Because it actually did feel like a disaster. And so being able, you know, I remember my days, you know, in CSR professional, you know, you see some disaster coming and you're getting the call from the C-suite saying, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Right. And you have to be able to mobilize quickly. Right. And so I think the lessons for, you know, companies were initially, I think, a little slow to respond because everybody was caught off guard and didn't really understand the scope and the scale of the community effect. But once they realized it, it's almost like they hit disaster mode, right? Okay, how do we move quickly to make sure that we're getting, you know, as much aid to the communities who need it as possible? I was talking to one of our members here who, you know, she ramped up a huge volunteer event in, you know, a matter of a couple of days, food packing event, to be able to get, you know, food assistance out to families. For companies, when their employees are saying, I want to help me connect with the people in my community who are doing this work, that they're at the ready, because it is really, from a perspective of a company, it is a disaster. How do you respond to disaster? You don't wait around for a month and say, we're going to give a grant to somebody. You have to be able to respond in the moment and very quickly.
Yeah. And as you're speaking, I'm thinking that, you know, the values of people wanting to channel their resources, their hearts, you know, their actions into something positive is actually, you know, those are the values that you want in your workplace, should there have been a disaster right in your workplace that was more business oriented. And so inculcating those values seems to me to be a good opportunity in these moments to remind yourselves that those very human values play a really important role in community and in business. And that, again, you know, that blurring of the lines could be a very powerful way to encourage that and have people viscerally feel the effects of contributing to something important and bigger than themselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
So We've been talking a little bit about, responses or non-responses from Minnesota-based companies. Let's talk directly about it, right? Some companies released public statements. Others chose to remain silent. One notable example was the statement from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which was signed by 60 CEOs, which referenced, recent challenges and called for a de-escalation of tensions. And of course, that statement generated a lot of conversation about the role of business leaders. Was it enough? Was it, was it all they could do? I would love to hear your perspective, not to put you on the spot, Andrea, but how do you think companies should approach situations like this? How do you assess the response that we saw?
It's hard because you're going to get criticism whether you do something or you don't, right? So that becomes a, from a corporate perspective, what makes sense for us and for our communities and for our stakeholders. I would say the most effective leadership really during that time really focused on people, not politics, right? So it's acknowledging, when we talked about the morale of employees or the anxiety that employees were feeling or the stress, all of that, acknowledging that employee experience and not acknowledging the employees were, many were having trouble, right? And then, focusing on that too, okay, so we have employees who are affected in one way or another. How do we actually help them? There are lots of ways that a company can jump in and support their employees. And then reinforcing company values, right? And so this is what we know. You don't have to make a political statement to say, we care about our communities, we care about our families, we care about our kids. Here's, that's always been in our DNA. Here's how we're going to help in this situation, right? Because our community is suffering. So here's what we're going to do. And then really avoid that performative positioning, right? So don't just say something and then not do anything about it. Like, oh, we hear you, we're sad, whatever, right? Without actually saying, oh, here's what we're going to do about it, right? Because that is something that's really important, and it's interesting too, because companies in the past who have said one thing and then actually turned around and done something that completely opposite, in conflict with their values, take a much bigger hit reputationally than a company that doesn't say anything, right? And so if the choice is between those two, my advice is don't say anything. And I think that's probably what, a lot of companies were thinking. But for the CEO statement that came out, I think I was really pleased to see it. I know there were some critics who said it didn't go far enough, or maybe they thought it was performative. But what I felt was important is that CEOs speak up and say, we care about our communities, we care about the families. And by the way, this is also a business issue, right? This is affecting the economic environment of our communities, right? Our communities are suffering. And so from a business perspective, it's important that we speak out. And I always feel like, companies are going to speak out about something. It is about the business, right? So it is about, how is it affecting all of us in this sort of economic environment? And that's a place where businesses have, the credibility to speak out and should.
Yeah, the say and do.
Exactly.
Were there any brands that you felt really showed up in a way that other brands could learn from? Because it's a fine needle to thread, right? And so, and I think I actually think it takes a lot of nuanced thinking, writing, planning, and of course, the impetus to act fast is right there. Everyone wants you to act fast. Your employees are waiting for a statement. They like statements, right? Because it gives them a sense of, okay, now I know where my company stands. Mm-hmm. Curious if you saw any brands who really showed up in an exemplary way that other brands could potentially learn from.
I saw a range of responses that I thought were good. One of the things that you and I talked about before was, not saying something is also saying something, right? And so making the decision, if you're not going to say something, what does that mean? It's okay if you make the decision not to say something publicly, But how you're responding internally is really important, right? So making sure that your employees are taken care of, making sure that your communities are being taken care of, and that that is aligning with your values, and you're actually drawing a straight line between these are our values as a company, and so this is what we're going to do. I would say the companies that really did well were the ones who thought about it as a disaster, decided that they needed to move very quickly, looked at the needs, looked at the expertise and the passion of their company and their employees, and then figured out how to activate, you know, as fast as possible. I did see one CEO did come out with a public letter. He was a private company, so a little different when you're a public company. But you know, did talk about why, you know, he didn't agree with what was happening, and that you know, as a company, they supported, you know, a strong and thriving democracy, and that was important for the business environment. And so, you know, that worked for him and that worked for his company because he was a private company and had different stakeholders. So again, it was very individual on like what is best for the company. But I think where companies may have fallen short is when they waited too long to do something, either internally or externally, or they didn't provide enough of an outlet for their employees to be able to participate and to help and support their communities, because that's, and also support their own employees, you know, in whatever they were dealing with at the time in terms of what was happening. You know, at the end of the day, companies have to show up for their employees, right? It's really important. And if you feel like your company doesn't have your back, that can have long lasting ramifications for your employee base and employee morale.
Yeah, I like where you're going. There's, you know, really assessing what's authentic to your company. I think that's actually what we're talking about, is a level of authenticity. Yes. And so I also really like the example of the private company, because I agree with you, Andrea. I don't think every company has to make a statement, nor do I think they should. So I'm with you on that. I do think private companies have a luxury of voice, where using their voice, they have, you know, less of some of the risks that those large public companies have. And actually, they can turn it into a value driver as well. We saw some small sportswear brands who really stepped up and made some strong statements, and I think earned a lot of attention that they may not have otherwise. And it was very authentic to their brand. And so I think, you know, private companies thinking about in moments, what is the role you play as a private company as well? What can you do that others simply can't do? So right. that more ecosystem mindset, I think, is really valuable. And then I think just sage advice from you on the focus on internal comms, even if you're not going to make statements inside, helping your people understand what you are doing, giving them an opportunity to be a part of, you know, that channel of goodness in a moment is tremendously powerful. And in fact, a lot of our data, we publish an annual trends report called The State of Corporate Purpose. And we've been tracking, you know, communications and support from CEOs over the last few years on corporate purpose initiatives. And what we've seen is that they're really holding the line. They are communicating internally. It's externally where there's a lot more reticence. But it's not just reticence. I think it's a smart strategic move, because to your point, you know, not every company has the right or the credibility to say something in those moments either. So,
right. Exactly.
Yeah. I really appreciate kind of your, you know, multi-pronged mindset on this. I want to, you know, beyond the communications, I'd love to just pick your brain a little bit about the internal orchestration that happens to actually mobilize. So, you know, these kinds of crises, you know, where employees are sometimes being arrested at work or opting to shelter in place, can't come to work, demands quite an orchestration from corporate leaders across different business units, right? So HR is thinking about workplace policies, protocols, helping affected families with assistance programs, keeping their people safe and informed. You've got local managers who need to be equipped to respond directly to frontline workers. You've got then these, which we've been talking about, the communications teams who have kind of a PR, you know, crisis or opportunity on their hands. Impact leaders, of course, need to move fast and mobilize support in the ways that matter without often having a lot of the information to act right, confidently in the moment. Would love to hear what you've found is most important for corporate leaders to be able to swiftly and effectively respond in situations like this.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a a coordinated approach, right? Which goes back to my analogy about disaster. You know, during a disaster, there are multiple parts of a, you know, multiple divisions of a company that are involved in the response, right? Because it requires all of those folks to be on the same page. So I would say from an executive's point of view, it's really thinking about setting the tone, right? Here's who we are. Here are our values as a company. Here's what we're going to do, right? So values and do, say do. And then from an HR perspective, I felt for HR professionals during this time because they probably felt, you know, the bulk of the pressure because it's thinking about supporting their employees, right? So their employees may be having mental health, you know, reactions, anxiety, depression, all of those things. They may feel unsafe coming to work. They may need flexibility, you know, from their managers in terms of when they come to work or what their hours are or how they're showing up, right? And they may need additional resources to be able to support themselves and their families, right? So HR was really on the line for this. And from what I hear, I wasn't involved in the day-to-day of that, but from what I hear, HR did step up for in a lot of big companies. Like we understand that our employees need help and we're gonna step up. And then from a communications perspective, you know, again, that's also really challenging role to be in, especially because anything internal is usually external these days, right? It doesn't stay internal. And communications professionals understand that and know that. But making sure if they are communicating and they should be communicating to their employees, it's like that there's clarity and their consistency in the message. And it goes back to what, you know, the executives are setting the tone around the say, do, the values, and then here's what we're going to do about it, right? And then I would say that this is a really important piece that it gets lost a lot, but the CSR leaders in those companies should be at the table. And many times they are, but sometimes they're left out. Sometimes they're forgotten. They are the liaison between the community and the company, right? And so you always want to make sure that you are, you know, aligning with what the community is telling you, that the business leaders are hearing from the community through your lens, because you are that conduit. And I think what happens sometimes is the CSR professional gets left out or is kind of, you know, a second thought in all of this, and really should be at the table from the beginning to discuss the company response and how to help, right? So that's if I have any advice for companies, it's don't forget your CSR leader, pull them in early, pull them in often. They have a lot to offer.
Yeah, that is brilliant and so true. I find so many CSR leaders know they've got information, they've got knowledge, they've also got partners on the ground who can give insight into those situations and needs. And so great call out that, you know, they are critical stakeholders at the table with HR, with comms, and I think can lend real positive impact in those moments. And I find the CSR folks are really good at threading across those different needs as well. They're trained in stakeholder thinking. And so exactly. It's most of their job. So actually that skill is deeply valuable in those moments of crisis. Yeah, that's a great call out, Andrea. So the city of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota have sued the federal government over the constitutionality of this surge. Do you see a future here where corporations might join these types of legal challenges as part of their CSR commitments to civil rights? Or do you think that that's much less likely to happen?
You know, I'll go back to my previous answer, which is I think it really depends, right? There's no one-size-fits-all answer to that question. I think it's really important, you know, whether you decide to be, you know, more public in your response or not, to understand what the value of your community, understand the value of your CSR work, your long-term strategic work, not to walk away from it because you're seeing some external pressure, but being able, you know, taking the opportunity to explain it better, right? To understand, so make sure your stakeholders really understand internal and external why you're doing the work that you're doing, how it aligns to the business and community needs. So all of that's really important in talking about your values to your, particularly to your employees. So your employees want to understand that they're working for a company that cares about its community and is actually doing something about it. The one other thing I would say is, and I've been saying this to companies through our members for over the last year, don't overcorrect, right? This is a point in time. Pendulum swings one way, pendulum swings another way. If you have a strong strategy, that is grounded in the values of the company, don't walk away from that, right? You might need to take more time to explain what you're doing, you know, to your stakeholders. Do that. That's really important. But don't walk away from it. You know, you've invested time, expertise, and resources in this. If that strategy aligns with your business and what you're trying to accomplish and your values, you should not have to walk away from it, right? It just might require some more nuanced conversations. And that's the biggest piece of advice I have for any company right now looking at this, because I think there was a lot of fear last year and a lot of companies were just kind of throwing away everything that they had worked on for so long. And again, it's a point in time. So how do you address the situation now and be able to stick to your long-term strategy?
Yeah, I think that's really good advice because of the, you know, pressure to act quickly. You still live in the city. It's still home to you. I would love to just come back for a moment and ask you, you know, you have an opportunity right now to tell our listeners what the city needs from your perspective. And so I'd love to just ask you, what does your city need from the rest of us right now?
I think continuing to support us, you know, as I mentioned earlier on in the interview, the media has, you know, kind of walked away, lost interest in this particular story. But here the story continues, right? And so, as I mentioned, you know, it's a little bit like COVID recovery right now, what's happening from an economic perspective. That fund with the Minneapolis Foundation is still taking donations and they're still supporting, you know, local businesses and restaurants, rent assistance, food assistance, helping kids through, you know, educational assistance, like all of those things. So if your listeners can think about us being in COVID recovery, it's a great analogy because that's exactly where we are. And families have a lot of needs right now. And you couple that with some of the economic headwinds that are happening across the country, certainly being felt here in Minneapolis at a larger scale because of what happened this winter. There's a lot of families who have, I mean, it's basic needs right now. It's just keeping them afloat. I know this, both City Council, St. Paul, Minneapolis are looking at providing rent assistance for families, you know, as much as they can. You know, their small cities don't have a huge budget to work with, but all of those basic needs are going to be an issue for quite some time. So I would say anyone who wants to support, please support, you know, Minneapolis Foundation, Second Harvest Heartland, rental assistance programs, all of those things need your support right now. And, you know, keep us in your hearts, keep us in your minds, because, you know, it's a, you know, as I mentioned, I'm really proud to live here. I'm not from here. I grew up on the East Coast and moved here. And I have just been amazed at the response that people have just come out of the woodwork to say. It was almost like we couldn't even handle the response. I was part of a group that was delivering food and there were so many people who volunteered. It was like, wait, we don't need all those people, but thank you. Right. And so it was amazing, but the need is still there. And if you can continue to contribute and support, and companies here, I think as well, understanding that the economic recovery is going to be long and hard. So what can companies do to provide some quick aid, you know, continuing that, you know, crisis response mode, you know, how do we get money out the door quickly to support our communities, and giving their employees their, you know, opportunity to continue to volunteer and support too.
Thank you, Andrea. We always end our episodes with the same question. And so as we sit here, you know, just weeks after ICE withdrew from Minneapolis, I'd love to just ask you, what needs to be said about purpose right now?
I think if there was ever an example of the role of business in society, it was these last couple months in Minneapolis, right? Businesses didn't sit back, even if they were quiet, they were responding and they were making a critical difference. And so I think understanding the role that business can play, and that's going to actually become, I think, more and more important moving forward as our society just going through a lot of transitions with AI, demographic shifts, all of the things that we're going to be facing in the future. Businesses have a really important role to play, and they don't really, they can't and they aren't and they shouldn't sit on the sidelines, right? How are they going to lead? And that leading doesn't have to be this public, visible thing that you do, but making a decision about you have a place in this community. How do you step up? How do you lead? How do you make sure that you are creating good in society along with, you know, driving your business goals? Those two things need to go hand in hand.
Awesome. Thank you. And I will just say back to you, Andrea, that as someone who is sitting outside of Minneapolis, outside of Minnesota, I'm in Canada, which sounds a lot like Minnesota. Our winters, I feel like we're honorary, you know, brethren, yes. But I have to say the pride in watching your community rise up and fight for humanity was, I mean, I just was like proud as a human and so inspired. And I think, you know, this is not the last crisis that we will be facing. And so much can be learned from just watching the strength, the resilience, the conviction, the action from the Minnesotans and the folks in Minneapolis. So huge thank you for just showing us what great looks like.
Thank you. And thanks for letting me talk about this. It's been on my mind, as you know. So I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about it.
Thank you for coming, Andrea.
Thank you.